Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
On tonight's show, we'll talk with Bay Area directors James Labrecht and Nicole Newnham about their Academy Award-nominated documentary, Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution.
Then we'll hear about Marin's very own Griot Theater as Joseph Pache interviews co-founder LaShawn Holcomb.
But first, let's check in on the state of the Castro with Supervisor Raphael Mandelman.
Since 2018, Raphael Mandelman has been representing the Castro, Noe Valley, Glen Park, and Mission Dolores as a supervisor for District 8.
He's championed such causes as homelessness, mental health, economic recovery, and LGBTQ rights.
And tonight we'll hear his thoughts on what's happening in the city's Castro neighborhood, the region's historic center of LGBTQ activism. Welcome, Supervisor Mandelman.
It's great to be here.
So let me ask, the Castro of the 90s was a thriving, affordable neighborhood where one could rent a two-bedroom flat for under $2,000, still have some money left over to buy a pint at Moby Dick's, the famous bar there. Today, a two-bedroom is going to cost you more like between $3,000 and $4,000. So can you explain what happened to cause this gentrification and what's being done to address it?
I mean, I think it's a story that's been told across San Francisco and across the Bay Area. The Bay Area's real estate market got hot and jobs were created and people wanted to be in these cool neighborhoods that had defined what was great about San Francisco and the Bay Area. And in that process, a whole bunch of people got pushed out and new folks found it increasingly hard to find a place to be.
So is this an issue of jobs without housing, or is there a role for more housing in the Castro to try to soak up some of this demand?
Yeah, well, I think there is. I mean, I think, you know, California overall has this incredible housing shortage and these astronomically high housing prices, rental and for sale homes. What I'm particularly focused on is the lack of affordable housing that's happened in the Castro. District 8, the district that I represent, has the second highest level of no-fault evictions historically, right after the Mission. And I think people that may have heard about, you know, the efforts that have happened in the Mission to push back on market rate development and make sure that there's more affordable development. And that's begun to show fruit. I mean, there are big buildings going in that are 100% affordable or mixed income. The Mission is kind of getting what it was demanding about 10 years ago. And has consistently demanded. And the Castro, the story has been different. Maybe there hasn't been the same level of community activism around it, I'm not sure what, but we have not seen anywhere near the level of affordable production in the Castro that we see just, you know, half a mile away in the Mission. So that's a thing I'm working on and trying to change. We've gotten the city to buy up a parcel on Market Street that's gonna be queer-friendly senior housing, and I'm going to be going to a Habitat for Humanity project that's going to have a ribbon cutting next week, and trying to get as much subsidized housing into the Castro and District 8 as we possibly can. But it's a challenge.
Housing is such a problem in the city, and I mean, obviously, another big issue that faces your district and all the others is homelessness. And you have a proposal called A Place for All. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So. Again, this is another issue that's region-wide. It's not just San Francisco. It's East Bay. It's up and down the 80. It's everywhere. In the Castro, there are, you know, dozens of folks who don't have a place to be, who really want to be in the Castro. During the pandemic, as, you know, throughout San Francisco, the kind of level of street camping reached a pretty high level. There were encampments. Neighbors were losing their minds. And some of these encampments were pretty unsafe places for the people who were in them. And during that time last year, the city started experimenting with safe sleeping sites, which, you know, is sort of like a bare minimum kind of shelter. It's like, we don't have a building for you, but we can at least ensure that you have a shower and access to a bathroom and safety and 24/7 staffing and just sort of the bare minimum of basic humanity. And through that, I was a strong advocate to try and do that. But it also got me thinking about, you know, could we make some kind of guarantee of a very basic level of shelter? Some cities do actually more than that. New York and Boston actually have rights to shelter. I think there's reluctance to do that. But can we at least say that we're going to have something better than the sidewalk and make that, at least that, available for anybody who's willing to take it? That's what my A Place for All legislation is about.
Well, I wonder, you've been the supervisor for a bit. And what's your first memory of living in the Castor or living in that district?
My first address that was in District 8 was just over the hill in Noe Valley. I was in law school at Berkeley, and thought it would be fun to be living in San Francisco. I'd grown up in San Francisco, but not, you know, in District 8. And so I got to live in Noe Valley a little while and, you know, have moved around like a lot of renters and now I'm an owner. Noe Valley was different even then. When I was growing up, it was, you know, sort of a middle-class neighborhood.
Right.
Certainly has changed. The Castro has certainly, you know, gotten much more upscale.
Your notifications are the back thing. Like, yeah.
You have these folks who've been there for, you know, decades living in rent-controlled housing and who are, you know, very, very concerned about what happens if they lose that unit.
Well, Supervisor Mandelman, certainly as a Berkeley Law employee, we're very happy to see you as an alum in this position. I wanted to follow up on your question about, or the question that Grace asked about your memories of the Castro. And the Castro, as people around the region know, really around the world, is known as a gay mecca, an LGBTQ mecca. And is that still needed today, given the advancement that we've seen in LGBTQ rights? I mean, at the time, the Castro was a haven in a very hostile country, but things really have changed. So what's your take on the role of the Castro in today's politics?
I mean, I believe in the importance of gayborhoods. I believe in the importance of physical places where people come together and build community, you know, all different kinds of communities. And, you know, cool things have happened with the advent of the internet and these other ways of meeting people. And you don't even have to be in the same country to strike up a friendship with someone. And that's really cool. But I think that people generally need physical spaces where they come together and actually meet each other and plot and agitate and have fun. And I think that queer people even more so need that. For me, as I said, I'd grown up in San Francisco. I had not come out when I was in high school. I'd come out in college. But coming back and discovering this neighborhood where, you know, there's rainbow flags everywhere and everybody's gay. And it was just it was a really affirming thing for me as a 20-something. And, you know, as a 40-something now, must I live in a place like that? Maybe not. And, you know, are things different for today's 20-somethings? Surely. But I do think that, you know, still, even with all the sort of gentrification and displacement, young queer people continue to want to try to be in the Castro, to live there, and will pay, you know, exorbitant amounts to do that, or will live in insane living situations to be able to have a space in that neighborhood. So I think there's still a need for it.
I mean, everybody needs to get a hot cookie now and then, right?
So everybody needs a hot cookie.
Well, I wanted to ask you about another citywide issue, but one that can be concentrated because the Castor has a very vibrant merchant district, which is crime and vandalism. And there's a tech billionaire, Chris Larson, and he has his own solution for that, which is to put more cameras up everywhere. What do you think about that?
You know, I don't know. I do know that merchants in the Castro are dealing with a lot. You know, the frequency with which windows are getting broken, sometimes connected to somebody trying to steal something, but sometimes just related to sort of the predicament of the folks who are out on the streets, for whom throwing a rock through a window seems like a good idea in that particular moment. So there's a lot going on. I have these conversations with merchants who are having challenges with people, you know, robbing from them, harassing their customers. And police will tell you, and I'm not sure, and I don't think they're entirely wrong, that cameras can both reduce, you know, bad activity and also help figuring out who's engaged in that activity. And I know that's the case. Now, the challenge, it's a challenge anywhere, because I think we're all concerned about, we talked about changes from the internet, but, you know, how does the easy ability to monitor every aspect of our lives, it's already happening, it's happening with your iPhone, but, you know, how is having surveillance cameras everywhere potentially threatening our liberties? And that's a question in any neighborhood. And then in the Castro, which has this, you know, history of folks not having a great relationship with the criminal justice system, having a lot of anxiety about revealing themselves and revealing whether they're queer or not. You know, it has sort of a particular, I think it's struck a particular nerve. So I'm not sure where we're going to land on this. I don't, as I said, I'm not strongly in any particular camp. I'm hoping that we can work something out that will assuage the concerns of people who are worried about protecting liberty, which we all should be, and also try to address what I think are the really reasonable concerns of merchants who are feeling like the neighborhood is just becoming less and less friendly for them.
Well, Supervisor Mandelman, we've got just another minute or so left, but next month is Gay Pride Month, June. So what does the Castro have planned to celebrate with the pandemic seemingly on the waning here? What will there be a gay pride parade, for example?
Well, there's not. SF Pride has announced that there will not be a pride parade or an officially sanctioned pride parade this summer, but they are going to have a number of events. There was an unsanctioned, unofficial pride parade last year down the traditional route on Polk Street, and I'm imagining that might get that might happen again. There will be a lot of cool activities. There's talk of a Juneteenth in the Castro to sort of in part of a larger effort, I think, to make the Castro a more friendly and welcoming place for everybody. Which, you know, we talked about sort of the nostalgia for the Castro of old. The Castro of old, you know, had some downsides, which were, you know, I think white gay men felt very comfortable there. Not everybody felt comfortable there. And so that's a thing that I think people are increasingly interested in seeing, maybe this pride and future prides, if we can have programming and activities that are more inclusive and get more folks into the Castro.
Well, I can't wait for Pride to be in person. That's one of my favorite San Francisco events of the year. So kind of do miss Halloween in the Castro as well. But I want to thank you so much for joining us, Supervisor Mandelman. It was so great to hear from you.
Thank you for having me. Happy Pride.
Happy Pride. And next up, we'll be talking with Bay Area directors Jim Lebrecht and Nicole Noonan about their Academy Award-nominated film, Crip Camp. Are you or someone you know disabled? Do you have any experiences or questions you'd like to share for them?
We want you to be part of the conversation. Give us a call with your comments or questions at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email at stateofthebay@klw.org. Or send us a tweet. We're at Twitter at State of Bay.
Welcome to KALW San Francisco. You are listening, and we're so happy to hear that. Tina Pamantuan is here. She's the general manager of KALW San Francisco. I'm Angie Cuero. We are very different people, but we're here for the same reason. We want you to become a member of KALW in San Francisco. Maybe you were a member in the past. Maybe you want to become a sustaining member. Reach out and make the connection now. 800-525-9917, or go online. You can find out all about it there, kalw.org.
That's kalw.org. This is Tina Pamantuan, station manager, and there are so many golden reasons for you to become a member right now, because KALW is constantly striving to find ways to bring in new voices and develop new talents. We do it all the time here, Angie, and we're proud of it, and it's something you can get behind. 800-525-9917. And the reason we do this is to expand the perspectives heard on public radio, because we know that you want that. More perspectives, more talk and conversation about the issues that matter.
800-525-9917. You know, there's so much here on KALW that you don't hear elsewhere. Before I moved to San Francisco and found KALW, the only way I could hear the BBC was via, I'm not kidding, shortwave radio. Ding, ding, yeah. So, you know, you come here, you turn on the dial to KALW, and you hear something you've never heard before. So many of our shows are exclusive to KALW. The training here is something that doesn't happen anywhere else. The voices here are brought to you from all different parts of our community. You support all of that with your gift at 800-525-9917 or at KALW.org, however you do it. We want to hear from you, and thank you so much.
All right, welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind, along with my co-host, Grace Wan. And back in the 70s, hundreds of teens with disabilities got a rare taste of liberation and inclusion during their summers at an upstate New York camp created especially for them called Camp Jeanette.
As one camper said, you wouldn't be picked to be on a team back home, but at Jeanette, you had to go up to bat. It was a true summer camp experience full of crafts, sports, friendship, and free love.
And from this sense of community and creativity sprang a group of committed activists, as many Jeanette campers eventually migrated west to here in the Bay in Berkeley to participate in the burgeoning disabled rights movement.
Tonight, we're joined by Oakland's own Jim Lebrecht and Nicole Noonan, co-writers, directors, and producers of the documentary Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution. It was nominated for an Oscar and recently won the award for Best Documentary at the Independent Spirit Awards.
So, Jim, thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay. And I want to ask you to just start by just painting a picture for us. A picture that it's summertime, 1971, upstate New York, and you wheel into Camp Jeanette, a.k.a. Crip Camp, for the first time. So what brought you there and what was it like?
Well, thanks for having us here, first off. And, yeah, going into Camp Jeanette for the first time was appropriately a mind-expanding experience. So I had been at other summer camps before that for kids with disabilities, but Camp Jeanette was this whole different place. I mean, literally everybody had long hair. It was run by hippies. And I honestly, when the bus pulled up, I wasn't sure who were campers and who were counselors. Okay. So it was that kind of thing. And that is partially, that's one of the many reasons that Camp Jeanette was so special, was that, you know, that there were people there that instantly became role models for me.
Well, did you get any pushback for the name, Nicole, of your film Crip Camp? I loved it, but when I saw the title, I thought, oh, whoa.
Well, that's kind of the intended effect, you know. I mean, I think Jim and I were very conscious going into working on the project that, unfortunately, disability is almost always represented in the media in kind of two tired tropes, you know, sort of the inspiration way of looking at disability or the tragic way of looking at disability. And we really wanted to throw people off. We wanted to kind of put people a little bit back on their heels and have them know that they're coming in is something that's actually A, not something that is like anything they've seen before around disability representation, but also something that's really being told from the inside out, you know, from a disabled person's perspective. And that was like the really incredible opportunity we had with the project, was to, you know, tell people this sort of seminal story of the origin of the disabled, or one of the sites of origin of the disabled civil rights movement, but from the perspective of, you know, a director that lived that, and a you know, cast of people who lived that journey. And so the name is basically using the word Crip as it's been reappropriated by the community. And we wanted people to maybe go, wow, what, you know, and come into the film with that perspective, not come into it with like, oh, I'm going to see a film about a summer camp for kids with disabilities, you know, and that was very important to us, that it have an edge and that it and that people come into it questioning.
Yeah, that is not this film. This film is not that. So, and it's so great. It's so great. Jim, I want to want to ask, was it hard to be the filmmaker and also the subject of this film? And for people who haven't seen it, there's a lot about you at the camp as a teenager and what your experiences were like there.
It could have been impossible, just about, but I had worked with Nicole as her sound mixer and sound designer for about 15 years previously. I started the company Berkeley Sound Artist in Berkeley, and Nicole was actually one of my first clients, and I had done three of her feature-length films. And so we'd gotten to know each other. We became pretty good friends, but also artistically, we had we were very much aligned. And so, in fact, I pitched this idea to Nicole, and she became interested and then said to me, you know, Jim, I think we should direct this together. Would you do that? And I was like, and I was sure, Nicole, that would be wonderful. But it was kind of, you know, I just, you know, it's kind of, you mean you want me to play on the team? That's great. Okay, good. And so our collaboration, I think, is something that I love talking about, because I think that we, through trust and really listening to each other, found what our real roles were within the making of the film. And it isn't like we didn't overlap. We weren't siloed, but I had the lived experience of disability, and Nicole had made many, many films before this. And so we kind of trusted each other, knew that territory, but had the ability to talk about it. I mean, oh my God, what a great and rare opportunity.
Well, and if for anyone who watches it, you can't help but notice in the credits that it's produced by a pretty famous couple, Barack and Michelle Obama, wondering how
involved they were.
So for listeners who don't know, it was the 44th president. So how did they get involved? Were they involved at, you know, in the early stages? Just, you know, how did they get involved, and how, what's the journey of getting this film kind of out there and produced?
Yeah, well, you know, it started out we were definitely like very, very independent when we started out. We had this footage that, you know, from the People's Video Theater, this incredible early video activist group who had come to Camp Jeanette and shot this black and white video footage. And we were able to get some, you know, early grants to start to cut it together. And we brought on board Howard Gertler, this fantastic executive producer and filmmaker, friend of ours. And he was the one who, when he read that Higher Ground, the Obama's production company with Netflix, was being formed, he immediately said, oh my God, we have to get this project in front of them, you know, because Judy Heumann used to work at the State Department. And this film is all about, you know, the things that the Obamas really represent and hold dear, sort of grassroots organizing and the ability for, you know, young people to change the world and uplifting, you know, stories from marginalized communities. And so we kind of stalked Priya Swaminathan, who had been hired to run Higher Ground at the Toronto Film Festival, and said, please, 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 you know, will you watch our trailer? And she called us and said, I don't know what you guys did, but I cannot stop watching this. And my bosses feel the same way. So this was, you know, before we even had an assembly, we had President Obama and Mrs. Obama on board. And they said, we really want to roll up our sleeves and make this film with you. And they really did. I mean, their company was very actively involved, and the president and Mrs. Obama watched three different cuts of the film along the way and gave feedback. And, you know, we were strategizing all along the way about, like, you know, knowing that we would have this sort of big global platform of Netflix and their brand meant that we could make so much more impact around disability rights and disability justice. So they became allies in that effort too.
Well, such a dream team. We're talking to filmmakers Jim LeBrecht and Nicole Newnham. They're the directors of the Oscar-nominated film Crip Camp. This is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KLW, San Francisco. I'm Grace Swan, along with my co-host Ethan Elkind. If you have a question or a comment you'd like to share, give us a call, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Well, the film talks a lot about and tells the story of what happened at that camp in the, starting in the 70s. But it's also a study and kind of a history of the disability rights movement. And you can kind of see the through line from the camp to the Americans with Disability Act that passed in the 1990s. Can you tell us a little bit about that through line, Jim, and how Camp Janae was sort of a seminal moment in the movement?
I mean, there's no doubt that Camp Janae provided this kind of fertile ground for activists. And I think that was largely or almost completely due to the fact that Judy Heumann was there. And I remember meeting Judy, you know, for the first time. And here was this fabulous woman who had an incredible personality who, like, was so motivating. And as I got to know her and talk with her, she had just prevailed in a lawsuit the year before to get her teacher's license. She had a teaching position. She'd gotten her license, but the New York City School District wouldn't give it to her because she used a wheelchair. And, you know, as a 15-year-old, it was like, wow, we can actually, like, fight back. like we can't, we don't have to just take what they're giving us. But Judy had that effect on many people. And I will say the environment at Camp Janae also was a product of the time. There were so many different liberation movements going on in the early 70s. And, you know, we would look around and say, well, we need one of our own, I think. So Judy winds up coming out to Berkeley to go to school at UC Berkeley, but also to really work at in the early days of the Center for Independent Living there on Telegraph Avenue. No, actually, was it even at Telegraph at that point? Anyway, she came out to work at CIL. And a bunch of us, you know, Judy was like letting us know. It was almost like calling back to the old country. It's like, the ramps are paved with gold. You must come out here, you know? And so a number of folks relocated. I mean, people like, you know, Neil Jacobson, he had gone to grade school, you know, with Judy. And so this wonderful group of people, including counselors and staff, over the course of just a couple of years, moved into Berkeley, which was an extraordinary place at the time. And it basically was kind of like recreating a community just like Camp Janae there, where there were people there to help personal care attendants, to help get you up in the morning and get you on your way. And people knew each other. And it wasn't like you were the only one. Berkeley was fast becoming this incredible community for people with disabilities, in large part to do with, you know, Ed Roberts, the folks that were living at the hospital on campus. They were known as the Rolling Quads, you know, and so this culture, this political activity was happening. So that's a lot of groundwork for what the rest of the story is, but the Bay Area became a place that was drawing a lot of activists. But even in New York, Disabled in Action, which Judy had started, was very active. And there were other organizations for different disabilities throughout the country. But in 77, Jimmy Carter had, you know, run on saying, look, you know, this HW 504 had passed, or this Rehabilitation Act had passed, but they never issued the regulations on this one section that basically said that if you receive federal money, you have to not discriminate against people with disabilities. And so Jimmy Carter ran on saying, look, I'm going to sign them nothing and we won't change anything. And shortly after he got into office, people were hearing that, you know, they may try to water this down. This led to a national day of action, and which wound up the people in the Bay Area stayed for 28 days.
Well, Jim,
yes, sir.
Well, the movie, sorry to interrupt you there. I just wanted to follow up on what point you made, because the movie is pretty remarkable in showing how this camp, it's supposed to be, I guess, a summer camp, becomes like this political networking event. And you mentioned this, you know, the backdrop of the 60s and the civil rights movement. And yet this story of the disability rights movement doesn't seem as widely known as these other civil rights movements that were happening concurrently at the time. And why do you think that's the case?
It's a question Nicole and I get a lot. Like, why? I'm ashamed I don't know this story, or why don't I know this story? And I don't think that the media really looked upon us as, people are only thinking about disability as a medical situation or a charity situation. People were not thinking about it as a civil rights issue. And so, you know, that was revolutionary for us to say, no, it's not, this is our civil rights and we deserve this. So, the media didn't cover it very, very well outside of some incredible people here in the Bay Area, like Evan White and David Louie. But it's, and in the long run, it was just that people looked upon us as less than.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Nicole, what's your response to that question about why this is such a lesser known story of the civil rights movement?
I mean, I think it is ableism. I think it is, it also is a very, it's a very radical story. I mean, it's a story that shows how people who refuse to accept, being treated as less than, and who keep going out in the streets and keep showing up, can make change across time. You see how it takes a lot of time. It takes three different presidential administrations, Jim was describing, but it is possible. And I think oftentimes stories like that are kind of buried later, so that you get this sort of sense that people have that the ADA was something that, at some point people just felt like being so generous, that they passed the ADA and everyone should just be happy for that. And of course, the ADA is really, as Jim often says, it's a floor, not a ceiling. It's just really the beginning. And so what we were really hoping to do with the film too is to just kind of reignite in people that sense of a belief in social change, and also to hopefully push people to reflect on not only how far we've come around disability rights, but how extremely far we have to go. We don't hammer that home in the film per se, but we're hoping that as people are watching it, they're thinking like, oh yeah, right. The subway in New York still isn't accessible. There's so much ableism that still impacts people to such an extreme degree. So, when we were at Sundance, Judy Heumann was asked that question on the stage after we premiered. And, why don't I know this story? And she said, why don't you're a bunch of media people, why don't you ask yourselves that question? Maybe you never wanted to see it,
Well, we have a listener comment. The listener writes, I lived through the 70s, but it was still such a shock to watch the film and see how the disabled community was treated. Sidelined and ignored is a good way to describe it. Thanks for making this film. There is something about, looking at the archival footage, and it wasn't that long ago, of this is really showing how people were treated. When you looked at that archival footage, did it raise issues for you? Were you as surprised as maybe the viewers are the first time, Nicole, looking at that?
Yeah, I was. It was interesting. Like when Jim and I had our first conversation about it, he was mentioning these sort of seminal moments in his mind of disability history. And one of the things he mentioned was Willowbrook, and I had never seen that Geraldo Rivera expose of Willowbrook, which has got to be one of the most shocking, moments in broadcast journalism history. And I'm a documentary filmmaker and I went to film school,
And for our listeners who don't know what that is, can you explain that?
Willowbrook State School was an institution in New York that was exposed by Geraldo Rivera on film as mistreating to an extremely horrifying degree the people who lived there. And it was eventually shut down, and it sort of was one of the seminal moments that kind of triggered the closing of a lot of these kinds of state institutions that were abusing people within them. And some of those people, young people in that institution, were actually sent to Camp Jened for a few weeks in the summer as part of an initiative of some of the Jened counselors who wanted to try to give people a break, and get them to a place like Jened. I was continually having my eyes opened by both the really profound things that people at Jened and in the movement were saying and doing at the time, and by the fact that I didn't know them. And so I think Jim and I really did try to bring that sense of kind of shock and awe and wonder that you know, I was experiencing as we were going through the project and other people working on our film to the viewer themselves. We wanted the viewer to be having their own moments, not to be told, this is what we think it means and here, now we're telling you, but to really create a film that would enable the viewer themselves to experience that kind of learning and that sense of having their eyes opened.
Well, and Nicole, there are just really so many incredible stories in the film, lots of just great moments of humanity from some of the people profiled in the film. But just curious for you, what was a favorite and what's a story that you had to leave on the cutting room floor that you wish you could have included? So, Nicole, if you want to answer that, or Jim, if you have a favorite moment, too.
I mean, there were so many things that I wish we could have included. One of them, we had backstories for some of the folks in the film that we couldn't include. And one of them was Denise Cher Jacobson, who's, you know, incredible person featured in the film. And she told this whole story about living on on the third floor of a walk-up building in Brooklyn that wasn't accessible, and how she basically was stuck up there watching other kids play, you know, and just how incredibly isolated she was. And Denise is just a kind of magical writer and storyteller. The way she told that story was so beautiful, and we had created just kind of a really beautiful sequence out of that. So that's one thing I still feel bad about.
Well, I'm sure it's hard to make those cuts. And Jim, what were some of the standout moments for you in the film, and what you might have had to leave on the cutting room floor?
Well, there's a lot of things on the cutting room floor. You know, again, backstories. Lionel, the counselor, African American counselor, came from the Deep South, had never, you know, I think that was his first plane trip up to New York, and like his whole church came out and like blessed the airplane and everything, and he thought he was going to New York, and then it was like, oh no, we're driving into the country. Well, I could have just been in Backwoods, Alabama, is what he told us. But in reality, what he found there is what we found there, which was a bubble, which is a place of freedom, and that he had never been treated as well by white people before in his life. Hmm. And so his story was amazing. And I think that for, you know, Nicole and I, we, you know, when we got a hard drive full of the videos from the People's Video Theater, and this is, we got 5.5 hours worth of video on a hard drive of this like 5-day period that they were at the camp in 71. And about halfway through, we opened up this video called Message to Parents. And there is a scene where we're all talking about how our parents treat us and how they're overprotective and how rough that is. And at one point, Nancy Rosenbaum starts talking. And Nancy has a pretty profound disability-affected speech situation going on. Very hard to understand. But there's the microphone in front of her. And she looks down and sees the microphone. You see her smile come up. And she just talked for a couple of moments. And we're all listening. You know, this is the day before, you know, looking on your phone while somebody else is talking, you know. We're all, and this is what I had learned at camp, was that, you know, you honor everybody. You give them the amount of time they need to communicate. You are not impatient. And when she was done, you know, the Howard from the People's Video Theater kind of goes, did anybody catch this? And the camera pans over to Steve Hoffman, who says, I think I know what Nancy's saying.
That's so great.
And indeed he did. He says, I have no privacy. My mother's there all the time. And we were when we saw that, we just like looked at each other and just said, oh my gosh, you know, if we could build a camp section of our film up to this moment and it works, mm-hmm. you know, we're golden.
Well, there is, I mean, even in this day and age, an overprotection that all parents seem to have about their kids. And there's something about camp that is so freeing. And we got a listener question asking, is the camp still in existence? Are there places, other places like this for kids that, you know, that people should consider?
No, the camp as it was at the time closed in the after the summer of 77. There were some, I think it kind of came back to life a little bit run by some other people, but we've heard tell of some other camps, kind of people saying there's some pretty cool camps. I think that there's one in Santa Cruz called Camp Krems, which is being rebuilt after a fire swept through. I think it was summer before last. But there's also like two filmmaking camps on the East Coast. One of them, Zeno Mountain Farms, which is in Vermont, just had a film premiere South by Southwest called Best Summer Ever. And it's a fantastic musical. And they got distribution. I don't know who it is, but it's going to be out. And you got to check this film out because it got a rave review in the New York Times.
Maybe they need the Obamas. They need the Obamas behind them.
Well, apparently they didn't. Well, you know, they kind of, you know, didn't. But it's there are places like that that are bringing youth together, for sure, to really kind of build community and lifelong friendships.
And Nicole, both you and Jim have mentioned this original footage, and it seems like it would be really hard to make this documentary if you hadn't had that treasure trove of footage. So I'm just curious how that came about, what it was intended for originally, and how you got access to it.
Yeah, well, you know, early on, I was so compelled by the idea of recreating Jeanette as kind of an immersive experience, and we didn't know how we were going to do it. So Jim and I were thinking, well, maybe we're going to cast young actors with disabilities and recreate scenes at the camp. And we were actually working on that. And Jim mentioned to me, but you know, you should look into this thing. There was this radical video coalition that stopped by the camp once. And I remember they handed me this early portable video camera and strapped the big video deck on the back of my wheelchair. And I think I filmed a tour of the camp. And I was like, say that again. Really? Like, you shot footage at the camp, you know? So then I just kept looking and looking and looking. I was working on another film, and late at night I would look and look. And finally, at one point, somebody digitized a magazine, and it showed up in an archive that was kind of an early video maker magazine from the early 70s. And I'm flipping through it page by page. And at the very end, there's a little ad that says, you know, Crabs outbreak at Camp Jeanette for the Handicapped by the People's Video Theater. So then we were able to track down one of the members of the People's Video Theater through a radical bookstore in San Francisco and the Mission, where he's on the board. And he, you know, we leave him a note. All of a sudden we get this email message and he says, yeah, I'm, you know, amazed to meet you. And I have, you know, 5.5 hours of footage on a hard drive. And Jim and I went over to Noe Valley, and when we walked in, you know, Howard Gutstadt sort of like, you know, burst into tears. It was very emotional. It's like, I think, you know, he set out to do work with, you know, Ben Levine, his colleague, like where they were setting out to bring video into communities as an empowerment tool. So they would film people, and then they would make these pop-up video theaters where they would show the footage immediately back to people in different movements and communities so they could see themselves. And so just imagine, like, you know, 48 years later, somebody you filmed comes back and says, I'm going to use this to now tell the story in this really important way. And they were so supportive and amazing. And, you know, we couldn't really have made Crip Camp without that material. Everything kind of comes out of that, you know, we discovered what our themes were, what the values of the project were, kind of like the language of the film, everything from the beauty of that footage, which I think is partially so special because nobody had ever really seen video equipment like that before at the time. And so there was no kind of like media awareness. So everybody's just fooling around, having a great time, like completely being themselves. And, It's incredible. Then, you know, you realize, wow, now we have footage of one of the great civil rights leaders in American history, Judy Heumann. But when she was 19 and, you know, organizing the lasagna dinner at the cook's day off, it was such an incredible thing to be able to kind of start there and build forward, you know, and really show like the long tail of how how movements grow and develop.
Jim, what was it like to see that footage for the first time after 40 years? Was it like watching family films, a reunion, or did it take you back?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. It was really, it was like looking at home movies. And it was very bittersweet because on one hand, I was reliving my childhood again by watching this. On the other hand, there were people there that are no longer alive that I really loved or had been really important to me in my life, in my younger life. So, yeah, it was a very emotional experience. And as we're going through these reels, you know, watching these, it's like I'm hoping I'm going to see, you know, Paul Godwin again, because Paul was a great friend and I've only seen a little bit of him. And so, yeah, it was, and it's amazing how it stirs up your memories, right? Like they're vague memories. And now I remember that place in full color, even though the footage is in black and white.
Well, Jim, you still got great hair. I love the hair from 15-year-old you. So that much hasn't changed for sure. So I wanted to ask about the reception for the film and specifically about the reception in the political social landscape of the day and where we're at with the disability justice movement now. So maybe, Jim, starting with you on that.
I think that the reception from the overall community has been very, very positive. I think that we really, I think traditionally there have been some stories that the participation of people of color in our movement has not been very well documented. And Nicole and I really strove to really do whatever we could to really put that in the proper light. So you're going to find that for the most part, people are very happy with the film. You know, with any film, people will say, why didn't you ask this question? Or why didn't you cover this or that? And really, this is like one story of thousands within the community. We really wanted to follow me and my friends from camp and their through line. But in reality, I think our film has had this effect in which there are many more open minds now to other films. Documentaries. I mean, we need to really need a documentary that really focuses on the lives of people of color, of people from the LGBTQ community in the disabled rights movement. It's really important. And we need people to be writing films and television shows talking about the real lived experience of people with disabilities. And if Crip Camp has done anything, it has proven to a number of people that, it, as Nicole kind of said, you don't have to have the same old depressing tropes, but that in any movement, the storytelling, if it's authentic, is compelling. But no one was asking us. Nobody thought there was a story there. And now I believe that we've opened up a number of minds where people are going, oh, yeah, so-and-so wanted to pitch something last year. Get their phone number. There could be gold in them Darhills, you know? and so now there's a real strong movement in Hollywood. Our friend Aaron Brown has been doing this big push on something called the 4-in-1 Coalition, which basically very quickly says, we are 1 in 4 in society, but we are underrepresented in Hollywood and woefully so in front of the screen. And that employment needs to be improved, and Hollywood has to take the same diversity and inclusion efforts and apply it to the disabled community, because people are ready to work; they're just not being hired.
It's so great. Well, Crip Camp is more than a documentary, and I wanted to let our listeners know that there's a lot of advocacy platform beyond your website, on your website, so and we'll definitely put that up there. Jim LeBrecht and Nicole Newnham, it was so great to talk to you about your film, and we recommend that everyone sees it. It's available on Netflix, and that's the movie Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you so much.
We've been talking with directors Jim LeBrecht and Nicole Newnham about their documentary Crip Camp. As I said, you can watch that Academy Award-nominated film on Netflix.
And we are in our spring membership campaign here at KALW, and we depend on listener support. So we ask you to please consider donating to keep local programming strong. You can help support KALW and shows like State of the Bay, the only live and local Bay Area focused call-in radio show in the Bay Area. I think I can safely say that. And you can support us by calling 1-800-525-9917 or going to KALW.org. We depend on listeners like you to help support programming like this.
And next up, our co-host Joseph Pache talks to LaShawn Holcomb and Simmel Austin about Marin City's Griot Theater. Stay tuned.
I'm Joseph Pache, and my guests tonight are LaShawn Holcomb and Simmel Austin. LaShawn is the co-founder of the Griot Theater Company in Marin City, a youth program that seeks to embrace and amplify brown and black culture through the arts by offering artistic training, mentorships, and performance opportunities to the children of Marin City. He is joined tonight by one of his student ambassadors, Simmel Austin. Welcome, LaShawn and Simmel, to State of the Bay.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, LaShawn, I wanted to start with you. There is this beautiful quote by you on the Griot Theater Company website. You say, if theater is a reflection of life on stage, then our stage will reflect every race, gender, and age. Please tell us how this quote connects to the theater company you helped co-create.
That quote came when I was an undergrad, and I just felt I didn't really feel connected to theater out there. I didn't really feel like I had a place in the conversation on stage. The plays they were doing were plays that reflected a certain group of people. And so this was one of the quotes I used to like affirm my place in those theater spaces. And so when I look at my students, I use this quote for us as well, because it's just affirming ourselves.
So how did you take that experience to creating the experience for the teens you are working with at the Griot Theater Company?
Oh, so, you know, I've been working at Bayside MLK for 4 years as the English and history teacher. And there's just some amazing stories that come out of my students, you know, when we're writing or reading, that I've been making theater with them. And I just wanted to create a space that we could just tell our stories, you know, us brown people, us black people really, really needing space to create.
So you say that you seek to give the children a stage that looks like them and feels like them, trying to correct the experience that you've had. How exactly do you go about helping children dig into their history and culture?
Well, I love taking stories that the students already know. And I love breaking those stories apart and allowing them to add themselves into that story.
So how did you come up with the idea to create the theater company in Marin City?
So when I found out about Griot culture from West Africa, I found out that Griot people are storytellers. They were responsible for the histories of their people. They went around from space to space, learning about different types of people and reporting back through music, through song, through dance, through acting, through poetry, you know? And I just looked at my students and I was, you know, we have that same responsibility. We have the responsibility to give our young people a space to really explore culture and who they are and all of their multiple identities. We have a responsibility to shine lights on students who don't traditionally have light shined on them. We have the responsibility to uplift our students and to amplify their voices and to get their stories heard, you know? They have these elders around them that they can go get these stories from. They have younger brothers and sisters that they can extract stories from. And I really want my young people to see themselves as griots. You know, there's not really a word for it. I want them to be on fire.
I understand that the children you work with performed something you called an oratorical. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, we just presented the oratorical in February as our first show. And every year we hope to take a brown or a black author, a writer's text, and we want to breathe life into that text. So within the oratorical, our first oratorical, we were looking at the life of James Baldwin. And we just took James Baldwin's text and we created songs to them. We created dances to them. We acted out his plays.
Samil, how did you get involved with the Griot Theater?
Well, I've actually known Mr. LeSean for a while. As he said, I acted in a play when I was much younger. And, you know, I live in Marin City also. And I do theater at my school. And Mr. LeSean asked me and one of my friends if we wanted to be an ambassador for his company. And so I was like, okay, yeah.
So what does it mean to be an ambassador for the theater company?
And so I go to theater lessons for an hour, and then the next hour I will help with the kids doing theater. So, like, that's my job as an ambassador, and soon I'll be taking over the social media aspect also.
Wow. Well, you're doing a little bit of everything.
Thank you.
So what do you like about being part of the theater?
One, I've always really liked theater, and I've been learning a lot of new stuff. Like, I don't think I ever would have saw myself, like, helping out with the website, and now I'm doing that. But I also just mainly enjoy helping the kids out with theater just because it makes me think back to when I first started doing theater.
That's great. That's great. What has being a part of the Griot taught you?
It's definitely taught me a lot, like time and patience. Kids are difficult. Even like working is difficult. It's also helped me adapt to newer things. Like, it just has made me start doing new things, which I've never done before. And I think I've had a lot of fun with this. Yeah.
So the ensemble will be performing The Queen of Cubs this June. I understand this is a special adaptation of Disney's The Lion King. Will this be a traditional version, or will there be a Griot spin on it?
A Griot spin on it. There's a Griot spin on everything. There has to be.
I figured as much.
It has to be.
Say more about that.
So this play that people are coming to see, this play is not about love. This play is about life. Meaning that we're looking at these real animal relationships. And so we're looking at it from an older sister's perspective. But this play is about what happens when an older sister knows what needs to be done for her pride. And what happens when an older sister wants to be the queen without having to take a king.
There's also something special about how the audience will be able to see this performance. Tell us about that.
So this show that you're coming to is called The Exertainment. And The Exertainment is the marriage between exercise and entertainment. And we're doing this show on a hike. So as audience members, you'll be watching bits and pieces of the show as you're walking through the hike. It's going to be, theater on location, site-specific. I wanted us to get outdoors. You know, we've all been locked away.
What a great idea. Where can listeners go to support the Griot Theater and to get tickets to the season finale, The Queen of Cubs?
So if you go to our website at www.griottheatercompany.org, we're going to be having tickets on our websites in the middle of May.
Great. Well, thank you, LeSean Holcomb and Samil Austin, for joining me this evening.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Thank you.
I wish I knew how it would feel.
Well, that was host Joseph Pache's interview with LeSean Holcomb and Samil Austin of the Griot Theater. To get tickets to their upcoming show or to support their theater, you can find a link to their website at the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And we should also mention that that was the Griot Ensemble singing a mixture of the Monica song with the preamble from the U.S. Constitution.
And, well, that's State of the Bay this week.
We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation.
So, Ethan, what's on deck for next week?
Well, Grace, next Monday, we're going to discuss rising tension over incentives for residential rooftop solar installations. We'll also hear from the SF Marin Food Bank on the pandemic's impact on hunger in the Bay Area. And last but not least, we're going to hear your interview with Laura Bazelon about her new novel, A Good Mother. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, it's a good one. And if you have any questions for our guests next week, email us at stateofbay@gmail.com or send us a tweet at stateofbay.
And for a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org.
Our engineer this evening was Dee Miner, and tonight's show is produced by Jillian Amblad. And we have to put a special thanks out to our good friend David Boyer, who has been our inspiration, troubleshooter, late-night IT genius, and the leader as we've launched our new show.
So I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan.
Good night, and thanks so much for listening.
Stay safe and have a great week.